Welcome to the Fuller Tracy Money Audio Commentary. This is Owen Tracy recording. It is 1 p.m. that is Pacific Summer Time, and today is Friday, March 15th, and it being Friday, it's the big picture, long-term audio and video for various different asset classes. I thought I would kick off and just look at the S&P 500, because it was up another 13 points in here today, but more importantly, this is the third close above 2,800 points. And particularly when you look at it on a weekly basis, this was a dynamic move in the market. We've had consecutive days on the upside. That's despite the fact that there has been a lot of drama. For example, Boeing, for example, pulled back by more this week than it has since the 9/11 attacks. And that's a very significant deterioration for a major share. It represented a rather odd set of circumstances where the Dow Jones underperformed or went down on days that the S&P went up. You don't see that particularly often. Well, when we look at the chart, there is obviously a trend inconsistency. We had some acceleration at the end of 2017. Then we had a reversion to the mean. Then we had a failed break up to new high ground. Then we had a much larger pullback, 20%. And now we've had a very impressive rebound. So on the one hand, we've had some trend-ending characteristics. There has certainly been evidence of resistance below 3,000. Obviously, 3,000 is a big psychological level. And there is, I think, really a considerable risk that we're going to see some resistance up there again. But what we are starting to see is an increasingly large number of companies breaking out to new all-time highs. So that's rather important. So far, the very large cap shares have not been among those companies. The kinds of companies that are breaking out to new high ground are, generally speaking, rather defensive in nature. And among those, you have a approximately 19 of the autonomies. And I think it might be opportune to look at those companies because then we'll get an idea of exactly what we're looking at. So, for example, L'Oreal has rallied really rather impressively and is now looking a little bit overbought in the short term. DSM has also rallied very impressively. Now, of course, those are two European shares. Ball Corp has been on a tear as well. Danaher, having bought up a piece of GE and its biotech sector, is looking also at new highs. Estee Lauder pushed on to new high ground in here yesterday. Airbus, benefiting obviously from the difficulties that Boeing is having, is also now at new highs. Cisco Systems, as it builds out the 5G, network is continuing to rally. LVMH has pushed on to new high ground, and that is really a very impressive rebound. Visa is at a new high, and of course that is representative of continued strength in the consumer sector, but also in the growth of the e-commerce sector. What I did find interesting this week was there was a report out from Spotify, and Spotify is obviously, I will come back to more of these shares in a moment, but Spotify is a company that is building out its e-commerce sector by allowing companies to just build their own websites and then providing them with an e-commerce platform for really quite affordable rates. I built a website on Spotify over a weekend, and then it's very simple to it is just simply seamless to have an e-commerce module posted inside it. So they have been growing out their business rather impressively. But what they released in this report was that that when we look at the retail sector, it's much more about a mix between the online and the brick and mortar sectors, that the growth in online retail is still growing, but the growth rate is slowing down. And that's, I think, rather an important aspect. But Visa is obviously benefiting from the growth of the online sector, because you can't shop online without a credit card. But The fact that it is at new highs is certainly encouraging. MasterCard is doing the same thing. Procter & Gamble is pushing on to new high ground. Then Shenzhou International is a major producer of clothing in China and is at new highs. Oracle had just about pushed on to a new high yesterday. Nestle has got a very similar pattern to some of these other European dividend aristocrats and is looking a little overbought in the short term. Ecolab is also looking somewhat overbought in the short term. 21st Century Fox, the takeover by Disney hasn't quite gone through yet, but it is at new highs. Diageo is also continuing to trend higher. And Yum Brands is continuing to trend higher. Pernod Ricard is also looking somewhat overextended on the upside. Well, one thing that I think is not going to be lost on investors is that a substantial number of these companies are listed in Europe. And Europe hasn't exactly been the place where a lot of people want to be invested over the course of the last few years. When we look at the Eurostox index, it has not exactly been the picture of consistency. Now, the index was in positive territory in here today. And in nominal terms, it has been rallying. But one of the reasons why it has not been doing better is because of the weakness of the euro. And if we look at the performance of the index, the Eurostox 50, on a US dollar basis, then it's been ranging for a decade. And if we zoom out and look at about as much history as we have, well, then all of this ranging does look to be more like a rather long-term base formation. And there is a progression of higher reaction lows within that base. So arguably, we could say that there is evidence here that there is accumulation underway in the European sector, but that it's probably going to require the euro starting to rally in order to really start to stoke investment demand. There are certainly contrarian signals that are appearing here. Certainly that was something that turned me on to Europe was that a friend who's a European portfolio manager was saying that in the people that he talks to and the research that crosses his desk, that he's seeing India is better covered than Europe is by analysts, and that's an incredible indictment of Europe. Obviously, India is a very high growth market, but Europe is a major economic zone, and it has been completely wiped off of the radar for international investors. And that does suggest that there are bargains. There must be bargains if nobody wants it. Then, obviously, China is very eager to buy up pieces of Europe. They already own the largest port in Greece. And the Italians are planning to borrow money from China through the Belt and Road Initiative. I find that quite interesting. It's not as if Italy doesn't have enough debt, but it seems that they don't read the news at all, because some of those loans that China has been issuing, particularly in places like Malaysia and Indonesia, not to mention in Pakistan, well, they generally come with a fat tail, and they work out rather expensive over the long term. Well, if China does have a record of buying things when they're cheap. It certainly did that with the commodity sector, and it has been hoovering up resources like lithium and cobalt around the world in order to feed its own domestic market. So the fact that China is starting to get interested in Europe is perhaps a potentially bullish sign. But of course, the big question is the euro. And the euro remains under pressure. So It has paused at 116, 115, 114, and now we're at 113, and it wasn't quite able to hold on to its rally in here today. It's at a minimum going to have to sustain a move above the trend mean in order to question the downward bias. But if the bureau can break above the trend mean, then that is likely to reignite interest in Europe because there is a relative discount in Europe relative to the US, for example. The PE on the Euro stocks is 16, and if we were to simply look at the Euro stocks 50, which is a more concentrated list, it's pretty much the same, which suggests that there is a very broad segment of the European stock market is around the same PE. When you look at an index of 350 versus 50 and they've got the same PE, that tells us something. But when we look at the S&P 500, then we've got 18.5. The fact that you have a substantial number of these big corporate autonomies that are breaking out to new high ground in the Eurozone, well, they are obviously benefiting from the weakness of the currency, but also from their relative value, because they have got these big global franchises, and there is an increasing likelihood that we're going to see easier monetary policy. And if we go back and think about what we're seeing on the S&P 500, well, I've been describing the potential that we could have a consolidation above the trend mean as the best possible scenario, and so far that does appear to be coming true. So that's really a very positive environment. We could even have an additional rally and a run back up towards this 3,000 level, and then there would be ample room in which to consolidate above the trend mean. So there's certainly the potential for that. And when we look at the Nasdaq, well, it also pushed on to new high ground in here this week, and this has been a pretty impressive rebound that we've had. The Nasdaq pulled back really rather sharply, and it had a sequence of lower rally highs between October and December, but this has been a very impressive rebound that we've had this week. So it has now clearly broken the sequence of lower rally highs, and it has got increasingly more room in which to consolidate above the trend mean. So this is looking like still a recovery scenario. Well, one of the reasons why we're getting this recovery scenario is because of the downward pressure that we're getting on yields. So, and I think it is really worth taking the time to look at some of these because when the commonality that we have right across the fixed income markets internationally is, I think, one of the most or the clearest signals of the conclusion that investors have reached and that we are at the top of the interest rate cycle. So the 2-year yield is below 2.5%. And that's clearly indicative of investors concluding that there are going to be no more interest rate hikes. But it's trending down. This looks like a distribution below the peak. And if we see a further deterioration in the yield next week, well, then that is going to be representative of a really a clear bullish phenomenon. So, when, for example, we look at the yield, it looks like a bearish chart, but when we look at the price, it looks really rather bullish. This looks like a very bullish consolidation above the trend mean. That is not simply suggesting that we are not going to see additional rate we're not going to see additional rate hikes. This is beginning to price in that we're going to get rate cuts within the next 2 years. Well, then that is suggestive of the bond market beginning to price in the potential for a recession somewhere out there on the horizon. Now, let's look at some of the others internationally, because the Canadian Central Bank had tried to raise interest rates, and the bond market is signaling now that that is over. So the 10-year now has gone from 2.5% to 1.7 in the course of the last 4 months, and it was at a new low in here today. So this is a significant rally we're seeing in Canadian bonds, and that is really rather suggestive that we are at a rather significant period here. I did see a rather interesting graphic in here today that was the extent to which the Vancouver market has rallied, and that was in let me drag this over. The Vancouver property market is we've often heard people talking about the San Francisco housing bubble, and this move that we've had in Vancouver is really quite extraordinary. So that's certainly something that is going to be at the back of the minds of the central bankers in Canada. Then when we look at Australian government bonds, then their yields are also contracting in here, and they're right back on the lows seen in 2016. Well, I think that's also representative of the clear conclusion that not only are is the RBA going to be unable to raise interest rates, but that they're probably going to end up having to cut them. And both Canada and Australia have got really very expensive property markets and highly indebted consumer sectors. And that represents a significant challenge for their respective economies, but most particularly, it represents a clear headwind to raising interest rates. That's particularly the case in Australia because so many of the mortgages are floating rate. So that would have a very immediate effect on the property market if they were to try and raise interest rates. But if that's the case, then that's likely to put downward pressure on the currency, and we've certainly seen plenty of that. Now, the Aussie dollar was in positive territory in here today, and it has continued to hold around this 70 cent level. But it is going to have to sustain a move above the trend mean in order to confirm that we're back in a demand-dominated environment. Now, what is it that could drive the Australian dollar higher if we're not going to see the potential for an interest rate hike? Well, it's potentially the resources sector. When we think about the fact that China is beginning to stimulate again, that and this time they are going much more for fiscal stimulus. Well, that is likely to reignite demand in the Chinese economy, and obviously Australia is a major exporter of commodities to China. So the ASX 300 resources index, it continues to trend higher. Meanwhile, the banking sector in Australia had, let me see if I can type correctly. It had encountered resistance in the region of the trend mean in here this week. It's going to have to sustain a move back above the trend mean in order to really confirm that we're back in a demand-dominated environment. Well, we don't have quite the same dynamics in Canada, and the banking sector has been resurgent, and it is back above the trend mean. It's being led higher by and golly, I've drawn a blank on the name of the private equity company, Brookfield. There we go. Sorry about that. It's being led higher by Brookfield Asset Management. I'm simply going to type in the US ticker. It moved on to new high ground in here this week. When we think about the Canadian dollar, then it has been pretty steady. I certainly haven't had the same pattern of deterioration that the Australian dollar has had. It certainly found at least near-term support in the region of the 2017 low just at the beginning of this year, and there is the potential that with the move to, I think, a reflation trade in the global economy, that Canada might be able to squeak through for a while longer. Now, when we look at other commodity producers, we see a very similar story. So, the Brazilian market is at new highs, and it continues to trend higher in a rather consistent manner. And perhaps it's also worth taking a look at the currency at the same time, because the real has been quite steady over the last 6 months. It certainly has not been weakening through the four level. Then, when we look at South Africa, the South African market has been largely range bound for much of the last 5 years. The South African rand has got questions about whether we are going to see it be able to break its pattern of underperformance, or whether this is a key area where we can start to see it starting to rally again. The sequence of lower rally highs for the dollar is now being tested. If the dollar sustains a move above 15, well then that is going to put paid to any argument that the South African rand can do better from here. Then, when we look at the Colombian market, it's also really rather firm in here. And I do want to round it out by also looking at the currency. And the currency has been strengthening up just about all of this year. One of the reasons that I think it is interesting to look at currencies right now is because we do have the rationale among investors where they are starting to look at places like Europe and the emerging markets, but it's usually that when you get the really big moves in assets, when you get both the market and the currency in your favor. So the Indian rupee broke back above the trend mean in here this week. And the last time it did that the fir was back at the beginning of 2017. It was the first, and prior to that, the time it had broken out above the trend mean was in 2014. So we can also say that in the course of the last decade, there haven't been many times when it's been able to sustain a move above the trend mean, but on those occasions, that generally has resulted in Indian instruments tending to do rather well. And the Bombay Banks Index is the only banking sector in the world, as far as I can see, that is at a new all-time high. So we know that there is an election coming up in April, and well, we won't have a result until probably the middle of May, but the performance of Indian markets is beginning to suggest that Narendra Modi is going to still be the Prime Minister when this election is over. And he was the original populist leader, and not least because he is a right-wing populist and more market-friendly and believes in free markets and economic development without the overhang of the Communist Party that dominated Indian economics for such a long time. Then he's been rewarded by investors. So that is a very significant potential issue or that is being removed from the risk parameters put on India if the Congress Party did look likely to win this election. Well, the last time we had a really big hiccup in the markets in India was after the Communist Part, well, after the Congress Party got into power. So when we look at the Indian market over the long term, this looks like a very clear secular bull market. It's been rallying in a jerky manner since 2003, and nothing has really occurred yet to question that this isn't still a secular bull market. India has got the largest population in the world and one of the youngest populations, with half of those people. So let's put some numbers on it: 650 million people under the age of 25. Upwards of 20 million of those are going to be voting for the first time in this election. And India has got a clear challenge. They have to provide jobs for those people. Well, the only way that they can do that is to stoke economic development. One thing that we've definitely started to see now is that some of India's largest cities are among the most polluted in the world. Now, that is terrible news if you have to live in one of those places because of the health issues that they generally are going to manifest themselves. But that pollution is because of coal-fired power stations, and that also means that there is greater economic development. So India needs that economic development more than it needs clean air at the present time. In other words, India's economic model is following China's, but probably with a 30-year lag. On the other hand, India already has truly globally significant companies that have really been able to achieve their global significance without a lot of state support. It is already a center for innovation, and it already has a vibrant consumer-driven economy. What it is missing is a manufacturing sector. Well, I mentioned earlier in the week that some of the people Mrs. Tracy has met while on her trip to China were a Singaporean couple with a chemicals business, and they were back in China on this occasion to move the entire operation to India. That costs have been rising for a substantial period, and in order to remain competitive, they are moving to India. And that is despite the fact that their cultural affinity would be more for China, and they rather enjoy visiting China and doing business in China. But the trend of economic governance, and most particularly political governance, is giving a lot of people pause. And India is probably going to be the place that benefits most. It is a massive potential economy with a very young population. That economic dividend from hundreds of millions of young people is something that we cannot simply underestimate. That was the driving force behind the economic development of China, the massive migrant population that moved from the hinterland to the manufacturing centers on the coast. Well, India is a substantially smaller country with a very long coastline, so there is ample potential for ports to be built in order to stoke exports. That is certainly the potential that we have in places like India. Then the other major population centers are all in Africa, and what we're starting to see there is that it's very low cost manufacturing is moving there, most particularly apparel. So the other point, of course, is that these countries have got a serious incentive to build this manufacturing capacity now, because the pace of industrial development and innovation in robotics is progressing at such a rapid pace that if they don't do it now, then they won't be able to do it later. China is building more industrial robots than any other country, or indeed most other countries combined. They know that the only way that they are going to be able to achieve their long-term goals, and I don't think it is an exaggeration. In fact, it has to be the base case that China's long-term goal is to become the biggest, most significant economy in the world. And they're going to do whatever it takes to get there. So the one challenge that China has today is to break out of the potential for a middle-income trap. And how they intend to do that is with massive investment in technological innovation, but with very large bets on what's likely to drive the global economy over the next 20 to 30 years. So this whole acrimonious debate about 5G and Huawei is obviously not just about Huawei and the industrial espionage and spying through an internet network, but it's also about trying to make sure that China is at the forefront of the next technological revolution. I'm posting a very important report from Oppenheimer in here today. Now, it is, I think it was dated back in June of 2018. But what it has is some very good graphics and commentary about the nature of the build-out of 5G. I've described 5G as an enabling technology. One of the things that you get with enabling technologies is a bull market argument in its own right. So when we look at Cisco, for example, was breaking on the upside. Nokia is another company that has well was out in the on the fringes of the investment community for a very significant period of time. But it is now starting to firm within its base. Ericsson is another company that is engaged in the development of 5G networks, and it has been rallying over the course of the last year within a very long-term base formation. The clear leader so far has been Xilinx, and that share has continued to push on to new high ground, developing 5G networks. So those are the companies building the network, and that represents a significant bull case for their individual shares as long as they are building it. But then, of course, you have the companies that are going to be selling 5G products and enabling connectivity. Well, Verizon is certainly one of those, but I think it's important to look at Verizon over the long term because it is now just about in the region of the 1999 peak, and it is starting to firm within that within its range. T-Mobile has also invested heavily in developing its 5G network, and it is at new all-time highs, and so has AT&T. Well, we're starting to see them beginning to offer products, and then you have companies like Samsung, which are now beginning to offer 5G handsets. And Samsung is an interesting share because it's objectively cheap, but it has been pulling back over the course of the last few weeks. With an estimated PE of 9 and a yield of 3.3, one could argue that it is a cheap share, and yet it has failed to perform. Well, what that suggests is that they're overstretched. Samsung produces just about everything, and they're also investing heavily in the production of batteries. Battery production is also going to be a massive enabling technology. I'll certainly come to that in a moment. But the other big point about 5G is that it is the enabling technology that will create the Internet of Things. Now, we are really just on the dawn of the Internet of Things. When you think about the potential that the smart home, the smart speakers, the web-enabled doorbells, and the smart toaster, the smart radio, these are all, and the increasingly smart refrigerators, they're all just the beginning of the Internet of Things. Then you have the potential that if we don't see the rollout of 5G occurring quick enough, that each one of those home devices could also become a node for the 5G network, and then that could boost the last mile of provision of service by the network. So that also represents an additional aspect to the infrastructure build-out, that products themselves not only accessing 5G networks, but also providing the network itself is a very realistic possibility. Then we have the clear beneficiaries of the whole system. Well, the beneficiaries from the cloud are the FAANG shares, the one thing that unites all of the companies like Amazon or Facebook is that they benefit from cloud computing. They benefit from the provision of software as a service. And Amazon today is back above $1,700. I think it is a little early to say that it has broken out because it failed at just this level back at the beginning of February, but it is certainly starting to look better. And Amazon has been the buy the dip share that people have been most engaged with during the course of this decade-long bull market. If Amazon is doing better, then that is a very significant, I think, triumph for the company, but also it's very good for sentiment. Google has also started to firm. Well, Google is also one of the primary potential beneficiaries of 5G. Not only has it benefited from the rollout of the cloud, its dominance of search, but it is developing autonomous vehicles. We have just a clue as to what that might look like with Google's Waze app. Driving around Los Angeles is a lot easier when you use Waze. It can shave upwards of 10 or 15 minutes off your journey in just about anywhere, but most particularly around rush hour. So that is the kind of information that can be relayed through 5G networks to every car, that every car could drive themselves. Then that makes crossing roads at intersections easier, and it makes the entire traffic management system easier. The evolution of autonomous vehicles probably means there's going to be a lot more vehicles on the road because that will remove a substantial cost from moving about. It will also remove a significant cost from food deliveries. One of the reasons why Uber is investing so heavily in food deliveries is because people got used to eating at home from after the credit crisis. And now, because people are spending so much additional time on their computers and on their phones, then the additional time that people spend in the so-called modern way of life has to come from something else they used to spend time on. Well, one of the things that people used to spend a lot of time on was walking around supermarkets and going to restaurants. So if you can simply order your food, then you've got a lot more time for doing the kinds of things you would rather be doing with your time rather than what are essentially chores. So that suggests there is going to be a lot more cars on the market. Well, one thing that I do find disquieting is the number of auto loan delinquencies have been rising. But delinquencies for other kinds of loans have not been rising. So there has to be something else that's at play here. Well, the clear answer is that people started probably driving for these ride-hailing companies and gave up after a while. The fact is that Uber, for example, is losing $2 billion a year. And the reason it's losing that money is because it has to pay its drivers. But the drivers themselves, one thing I've noticed is that when I talk to my Uber driver going around Los Angeles, then it's usually not their main job, but that they do other things as well. Then, when I go with my daughters to fencing competitions in places like Missouri or Cleveland or Arizona in the last few months, then talking to the Uber drivers, it really is their only job, and many of them are in pretty dire straits. Well, by the time you've paid for your vehicle and paid the insurance and paid for the maintenance and the gasoline, then there's probably not a lot left over. Well, then if you can get another job, you would probably take it. But Uber and Lyft together have approximately 1.5 million drivers in the USA. So, when we look at the jobless claims, it's been bobbling around the 200,000 number level for all of this year so far. Now, this is not the first time that this number has been going sideways. There have been plenty of other occasions during this trend. But the moving average is just starting to turn upwards. So we do have to pay attention to this because if unemployment starts to trend higher, then that is a very significant, clear signal that we are at a point where the economy is starting to slow down. Then we have to think about what the bond market is pricing in, that bonds are very clearly pricing in that we're at the top of the interest rate cycle and potentially that we're going to see interest rate cuts. And high yield spreads have not contracted through the 200-day moving average. Now, we've definitely seen that stock markets are doing better. They are pushing through their respective trend means, and an increasingly large number of companies are pushing on to new all-time highs. The majority of those companies are rather defensive in nature. And the high yield sector does have this issue outstanding that there is a very large slug of debt that is rated treble B. And that really means that it's only a couple of notches above junk. Well, junk and high yield are the same thing. And in the event that we do get a slowing economy, then we are going to have some downgrades, most particularly for some very big issuers. Now, we have potentially seen one of the solutions that companies can deploy in order to hang on to their investment grade rating. But it represents a massive sacrifice for the company. So General Electric started off in 2016 at $30 and now it's at 10. And along the way, they've had to sell off very significant portions of the company. Today, the company is a shade of what it used to be, and arguably, it's had to sell off the best bits. So that's a very significant issue, and it is a massive sacrifice in order to hold on to their investment grade rating. Well, if companies then stop paying dividends and start to sell off bits of their businesses, we also know that private equity has got a massive pool of capital available to sell off, or excuse me, to buy up at the assets that are going to be sold off. It's in the order of $2 trillion. So the only thing that could potentially countervail the very clear risk that we're going to see the high yield spreads starting to do better is that we then see companies making very significant sacrifices. The one thing that I'm very much reminded of is the fact that the kind of pattern that we have in high yield at the moment is very similar to what we saw in 2014. And if we go back and look at 2014, we had the pop on the upside, then we had a reversion to the mean, and it was subsequently that we had a big move above the 600 basis point level. Then when we look at 2008, well, it was really 2007, we had the pop on the upside, we had the reversion to the mean, and then we had the move back above the 600 basis point level. It really is the 600 basis point level represents a key area where people start to get antsy about the potential for high yield to become a problem. And I do think that if we are going to have a somewhat slower economic growth environment, then it is those highly indebted companies are those that are going to represent some of the biggest risks to stock market performance. But that's not a particularly big issue for companies like Google or Facebook, they don't have any debt. So their likelihood of being downgraded or by the market is rather small, and therefore that's one of the reasons why they continue to outperform. If we then look at what if we looked at some of the commodity exporters and the industrial resources have been steady in the region of the trend mean. So the six LME traded industrial metals have been really quite firm. The continuous commodity index, on the other hand, has been very range bound over the course of the last couple of years, but it is starting to steady. Part of the reason that it's steadying is that it's made up of lots of different commodities. So lean hogs are starting to firm, and they rallied rather impressively in here this week. Well, that is at least in part because China is now buying hogs again to try and rebuild their supplies after the, well, they're actually still dealing with the African swine flu. Then wheat prices have been really deteriorating very sharply over the course of the last few weeks, but they were up in rather dynamic positive territory in here this week. So there is scope here for an additional short covering rally. And soybeans, which have also been out on the fringe and nobody really interested in them, are beginning to steady from the 900 cent level and at least pausing in the region of the trend mean. Then cotton prices, which again have not been doing much of anything, are at least testing the region of the trend mean following a firmer performance in here this week. And orange juice, which had also been trending down in a dynamic manner, or well, in a persistent manner, was up in a dynamic manner in here today. Then coffee prices are right in the region of the psychological dollar level and have not yet shown much sign of firming, but they aren't going down much either. Well, what this is starting to suggest is that commodities are cheap. I mean, there is no argument about that. They have pulled back very dynamically, especially in the soft commodities sector. The trade war has weighed on this sector. If the trade war improves, then that is not just likely to be positive for the stock market, but also potentially positive for commodities. Then, of course, if we can see the dollar's strength moderating, if and what interest rates are starting to, or what bond yields are suggesting, is that interest rates are going to fall. And if interest rates are going to fall, then that should be not quite as bullish for the dollar. And if we get a less dollar bullish environment, then commodities generally should start to do better. That's also particularly important for gold. Now, gold prices have been steadying over the course of this week from the region of the trend mean, and they've been ranging below $1,400 since 2013. So this is a very lengthy base formation. And if we do get a weaker dollar, then gold is a monetary metal, and the way you make money in the currency markets is matching the strongest with the weakest currencies. And gold is among the strongest currencies right now, but it's just that the dollar is a little bit stronger. Well, if the dollar starts to weaken, then that will be really quite bullish for gold. And this looks like a rounding characteristic in terms of the medium term. So if it can sustain a move above $1,400, we are back in a demand-dominated environment that is certainly more medium term rather than short term in nature. Now, obviously, then the counter argument is that the Dow gold ratio has been expanding since 2011, and it took a leg up again in here today. And the more back history we look at, the more cyclical it becomes. So We've seen that since the early 1900s, there have been three significant peaks, and the most recent trough was in 2011 when gold peaked. Generally, these moves on the upside have been pretty aggressive and persistent. And this move that we've had in terms of the Dow outperforming has been really rather swift by historical standards. What I suspect is that we have evidence previously of very rangy, choppy environments, and that is probably what we're going to get from gold starting to outperform again if it starts to move above $1,400. That there are going to be pockets of time when the stocks will underperform. The very big question is what is going to happen with all the debt? I see there that Century City Mall has just been evacuated amid reports of a gunman. I live only about half a mile from there, so that's not particularly good news. When we look at the Dow gold ratio, we have the cyclicality. We have the 36 years between peaks, which suggests that the next major peak in stock markets is probably not going to be until about 2035. The rollout of 5G, the rollout of the battery sector, the innovations that we're seeing in energy, not just in batteries, but also in oil itself, that there is the very strong likelihood that we are going to see oil prices ranging rather than trending for the foreseeable future. And these are, I think, very powerfully bullish factors. But then you have the other side of the equation. We have been persisting on debt for an awfully long time. There has been a very clear surrender of the manufacturing capacity in the West in order to try and support the economies in the emerging markets and bring them into the global fold and try and democratize those places so that we can create a harmonious global society. And it's worked in some places and not in others, and most particularly, it didn't work in China. Those manufacturing jobs were sacrificed, and so that has created millions of people that are disaffected. What we are starting to see internationally is much more social unrest. The fact is that the status quo has not delivered on the improving standards of living for most people that they were anticipating. The improvement in social services has been funded with debt, and the quantity of debt has continued to rise, but people just do not have the same sense of value and worth from receiving subsidies as they do from making money themselves. That, in fact, gets right back to controlling the modes of production. So these are very significant issues. One of the reasons why we are getting this massive uptick in populism, but not just populism, but anger. And that anger is manifesting itself in multiple different ways. That we have the rise in terrorism, but it's not simply, these are not state actors. These are people that are trying to express a view, and their view is completely at odds with a harmonious society. But it is symptomatic of this dysfunction that we have in the political system. What is very likely is that this rise in populism is not over, but that it is going to become even more pronounced. And that's a very clear risk, because what we are now starting to see is that the potential for debt accumulation on a grand scale is starting to improve. Now, that doesn't necessarily mean that it's a good thing, but the potential for it is certainly increasing. Modern monetary theory is a solution. It's potentially not a very good solution. And there is a clear risk that we are going to see governments blowing out their deficits. And that is not being reflected in the bond markets today. Well, what the bond markets are therefore concluding is that the risk from deflation is greater than the risk from inflation at the present time. Eventually, those debt burdens are going to become an issue. And when they are, well, then we're going to start to see the downtrends in government bond yields broken. But that is just not the case right now. Then we have the potential, and this is a potential outcome, that technological innovation is going to deliver on the kinds of productivity growth that will sustain the debt burdens. That is potentially an outcome from the kind of secular bull market that is evolving in terms of the provision of 5G, of battery and energy innovation, of the rollout of autonomous vehicles, and then also the innovation that is happening in the healthcare sector. So we are at a point where there is a very significant argument going on about the fruits of innovation and where those fruits should be distributed, and the kind of life that people want, and their thirst for self-worth. So these are, I think, very significant issues. It suggests that we're going to have a much more volatile political environment, and there is the risk that we're going to see either protectionism or antitrust or higher taxes or some mix of those in various countries. That is a risk from the deterioration in the status quo, because when the status quo breaks, then you get a lurch to the fringes, and that is what we've seen time and again from various countries. So those are the potential risks, but obviously the solution is it in terms of technological innovation, the rise of the global consumer, because there are masses of young people in specific countries that have got the clear potential to benefit from a demographic dividend. And then, of course, when we start to marry the technological innovation with the rise of the global consumer, we have also got serious potential for global growth. And then you have the fact that energy is not going to be trending higher. So there is the scope that the growth that can be achieved from the technology sector can potentially generate the kind of productivity that could help to ameliorate the size of the debt burdens. That is by far the most bullish scenario that's possible. In the event that technology is not quite strong enough in terms of growth, then we are going to have a debt problem. But we can't say we have a debt problem until yields start to turn upwards, and they are not turning upwards, they are trending down at the moment. I think that is the clearest conclusion that we have right now. Well, if yields are coming down and banks are, or excuse me, that central banks are not raising interest rates, and governments are spending on the fiscal front, that is positive for asset prices. So that is likely to add an additional leg higher to equities if we continue to see firming. And as long as the region of 200-day moving averages is holding, we give the benefit of the doubt to the upside. Then there is the potential for gold to do better, because if countries are clearly going to blast out their deficit spending, that is going to put pressure on their respective currencies, and therefore gold, being in relatively limited supply, benefits on that front. And I think with that, I will leave you for the weekend, and I wish all the best to all of you.